Minette, just finally, if you could mention the filmmakers who've inspired you and inspired this film.
For sure. Well, you know, the thing is that this was not a film which is like a regular vérité observational documentary, and I wanted to make something which is cinematic and, you know, felt aesthetic and beautiful. And so cinematographically, I was really very influenced by this Russian filmmaker, non-fiction filmmaker called Viktor Kosakovsky, who has these incredible, you know, incredibly well-shot films and like phenomenal panning and tilting. And so I'd heavily recommend him. In terms of fiction, I, you know, the Russian great Tarkovsky was a huge influence. In terms of the edit, a New York-based filmmaker called Gianfranco Rossi was very, very, very influential. Other than that, just, you know, a ton of films that use slow takes and have a particular relationship with ecology or the world or the planetary or nature have been important. For instance, Terrence Malick was a profound influence. And also people
who are able
to hold...
We have 10 seconds, Shailak.
And also, like, are able to hold the political alongside the aesthetic is what has been very, very influential for me. Thank you.
Shailak Sen, thank you. The Delhi-based director of the Oscar-nominated documentary All That Breathes premieres Tuesday, February 7th on HBO. Speaking to us from Munich, Germany, I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, starting Friday, February 3rd, until Saturday, March 4th. Screenings will take place every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, bringing live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. Films will be screened at PCC Cascade, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org. That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening throughout the month of February in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's folk music programs.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the one thing Oregon needs more of to make a switch to greener energy. An Oregon congresswoman speaks up for women crossing state borders to get reproductive care.
Now, more than ever, I'm proud to be from Oregon because we have risen to the occasion. We've opened our doors and our arms to women from across the country.
And what a new report shows about people buying guns in the U.S. KBOO takes a closer look. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon is requiring utilities to switch to renewable energy sources by the year 2040, but it will need to build more transmission lines to reach that goal. Eric Tegedoff reports on how these often ignored lines are key to the Northwest's renewable future.
Oregon is pursuing an aggressive climate plan to switch to renewable energy sources, but it faces one often overlooked issue, enough high-voltage power lines to facilitate the transition. An Oregon law requires utilities to cut greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2040. However, the Northwest's aging transmission lines will need a reboot to ensure wind and solar resources on the east side of the Cascades make their way west. Emily Moore with the Northwest-based think tank Sightline Institute says lines can take 10 to 20 years to build and the grid is nearing capacity.
We need to be looking much farther into the future in order to start those complicated processes now and not wait a decade or 20 years until it's much more urgent.
Moore says creating a plan for building power lines in the region is going to be critical. She says a glut of wind and solar projects in the Northwest can't come online because there isn't the necessary transmission capacity yet. There are several hurdles to siting transmission lines. Negotiations are required with landowners and tribes, and not every community likes the idea of having tall lines stretching across the land. Fred Hewitt is based in Portland with the Northwest Energy Coalition and says public engagement is key, especially with the communities where these lines may end up going.
Their voices are really important, and getting benefits to those communities as a result of the new transmission is also very important. And being protective of the environmental and cultural resources that may be affected by new transmission is also important. So all those things come into play here.
Moore says the biggest transmission line player in the region is the Bonneville Power Administration, a federal entity that owns about three-quarters of the high-voltage lines in the Northwest.
We do have, of course, our Northwest Congressional Delegation, which has influence over BPA, and many folks think that they should be encouraging or at least engaging with BPA on more proactively building new lines.
She adds that states should do everything they can to maximize energy sources like rooftop solar, which reduce the need for transmission lines. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A new report from the government reveals a lot about how people are buying guns in the U.S. KBOO's Josh Salem takes an in-depth look.
Attorney General Merrick Garland directed the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to produce the first comprehensive study of criminal gun trafficking in more than 20 years. That report shows the time between when a gun was purchased and when it was recovered from a crime scene is getting shorter. That means firearms bought legally are more quickly being used in crimes around the United States. The report also demonstrates a rise in the use of conversion devices, which make a semi-automatic gun fire like a machine gun, and an increase in seizures of ghost guns, privately made firearms that are hard to trace. Much of that information has not been widely available before. Its release is aimed at helping police and policymakers reduce gun violence. The report shows 54% of guns that police recovered in crime scenes in 2021 had been purchased within 3 years. That represents a double-digit increase since 2019. The quicker turnaround can indicate illegal gun trafficking or a straw purchase, when someone who can legally purchase a gun buys one to sell it to someone who cannot legally own guns. In fact, the increase was driven largely by guns bought less than a year before. The number of new guns overall in the U.S. has recently grown significantly. Sales shattered records during the coronavirus pandemic. The report also noted most guns used in crimes changed hands since their purchase. In particular, there's been an epidemic of stolen guns. More than 1.07 million firearms were pilfered between 2017 and 2021. 96% were stolen from private individuals. The report documented a more than five-fold increase in the number of devices that convert a legal semi-automatic weapon into an illegal fully automatic version. Between 2012 and 2016, the ATF retrieved 814 of those. That number jumped to 5,414 during the five-year period documented in the report. A conversion device was recently used in a Sacramento mass shooting between rival gangs. That incident left 6 people dead and 12 wounded. Finally, the document also traces the rise of ghost guns, privately made firearms without serial numbers. Those have increasingly been turning up at crime scenes nationally. The ATF traced more than 19,000 privately made firearms in 2021, more than double the number from the year before. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
New Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas is calling on lawmakers to protect women's rights to travel for abortions. She delivered remarks today to support the Ensuring Women's Rights to Reproductive Freedom Act.
I want to thank my women warriors and allies behind us for doing the work. So I am happy to be here as reinforcement now as a new freshman member. When the court overturned Roe v. Wade, millions of women were robbed of our rights to make deeply personal healthcare decisions. And it's very fortunate that my home state of Oregon still allows access to reproductive care. And I have to say, now more than ever, I'm proud to be from Oregon because we have risen to the occasion. We've opened our doors and our arms to women from across the country, and providers are now seeing women, as these folks have stated, from all over the country, but definitely from some nearby states. And we're going to continue to do that until reproductive rights are restored across the nation for all. Because as the visionary civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer once said, nobody is free till everybody's free. All of us have a constitutional right to travel, and the government has no business with that freedom. So let me be clear. Women who seek reproductive care in Oregon are welcome today, tomorrow, and always. And we won't back down from that right. Thank you.
That's Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas. The Global State of Democracy Initiative has added the United States to its list of nations whose democracies are backsliding for the first time. And a new report suggests that ensuring equal rights for women is critical for achieving a fully functioning democratic society. While mortality rates for pregnant women have decreased globally, they continue to rise in the U.S., with black women three times more likely to die during pregnancy than white women. As Erica Lottis reports, women's rights are cited as a canary in the coal mine for democracy.
The United States was added to a list of democracies seen to be headed for trouble for the first time in 2021, and a new report suggests that the nation will continue to be at risk until it can ensure equal rights for women. Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, in an analysis recently published in Ms. Magazine, points to the nation's ongoing gender gap in political representation. While women make up half of the U.S. population, fewer than one in three congressional representatives and state legislators are women.
Colorado is an outlier at this point. It joins the state of Nevada as the only two states that have women in the majority. In every other state, legislatures are at about 30% women.
The current Congress is about 28% women, marking the highest level of participation in U.S. history. Some have attributed America's declining democracy to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Others cite the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, which leaves the question of a woman's right to control her own body for state governments to decide, and warn attacks on women's rights could now accelerate. Wolf sees the nation's persistent track record on gender equity throughout its history as the potential smoking gun for the decline in democratic values, from denying women the right to vote until 1920 to failing to ratify an Equal Rights Amendment. She says America continues to be an exception among developed nations.
85% of the UN member states have explicit constitutional provisions that prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex or gender. We do not. We do not have an Equal Rights Amendment still in our federal constitution.
While mortality rates for pregnant women have decreased globally, they continue to rise in the U.S., with black women three times more likely to die during pregnancy than white women. Wolf says if we want a better world for our daughters, one that values equality and participatory democracy, women's rights have to be part of the conversation.
You can't have a true functioning democratic society if half of the population does not have or is able to enjoy equal rights and participation in that democracy.
This story was produced with original reporting from Jennifer Weiss-Wolf of Ms. Magazine. This is Eric Galatis reporting.
As we reported here on KBOO Tuesday, new Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has released her ambitious plan for the next 2 years. This budget has a special focus on houselessness, mental health, and addiction. Here, she explains the plan to tackle these very tough issues.
I promise to take on the biggest challenges facing families and communities across our state and to deliver results. Oregonians are looking for action, real action that makes a difference in their everyday lives. That is why on my first full day in office, I declared a homelessness state of emergency and signed an executive order to increase housing supply by 80%. In that same vein, I present my first recommended budget, this budget for the 2023-25 biennium. You can see that the title is mission focused, and that's because my budget outlines a path to make significant progress on the three top issues of shared statewide concern: housing and homelessness, mental health and addiction services, and education. We must acknowledge that while Oregonians are demanding action on these priorities, our state is also entering into a very challenging and complex budget environment. About $3.5 billion of one-time funding, spurred by resources from the federal government, is about to expire. I believe, however, that we still have a path to make targeted investments thanks to years of prudent budget management to build historic reserves. My recommendation in my budget is to keep the existing $2 billion of reserves in place. Those are important savings accounts for future crises. But the budget also says let's redirect $765 million that would have been automatically added to these reserves into targeted investments aimed at better serving Oregonians in these three key priority areas. While my top priorities will be the focus of today's conversation, I want to emphasize that this proposal represents a balanced budget that includes investments in every agency to tackle other pressing issues across the state, enhancing our historic investment in the state's water supply, fixing the public defense crisis, supporting Main Street revitalization across rural Oregon, implementing essential climate change policies, and making college more affordable. All of these important issues are also addressed within my budget recommendations. I also want to highlight the expertise and work of the state's Racial Justice Council, which will have a strong, ongoing partnership in my administration. The council has been working diligently with the state chief financial office and state agencies since August of last year to ensure historically underserved communities have significant voices in the budget process, and that helped to embed equity in this budget. I will keep working in partnership with the Racial Justice Council to reduce racial disparities and transform how the state provides services to support all Oregonians. Every Oregonian, no matter their race or zip code, deserves to have the same opportunities. My mission as Oregon's governor will always be to deliver results and move the state forward to build the Oregon we all want to live in. This vision for Oregon's future cannot be realized in one budget cycle, but this plan today provides a roadmap for how we are going to reach this state's long-term goals. So let me start with my first priority, housing and homelessness. The housing crisis is one of the largest emergencies we have ever faced in Oregon, and the human suffering it causes to individuals, families, and communities is absolutely unacceptable. We must act now to provide immediate relief to unsheltered Oregonians and to prevent thousands of families from becoming homeless. In my budget, I'm recommending a significant investment in affordable housing production and preservation, $1 billion. That includes $770 million to build more affordable homes for both renters and new homeowners, $118 million to preserve existing affordable homes, and $4 million to support the replacement of old and inefficient manufactured homes to provide safe and energy-efficient homes for households. I'm also proposing the creation of a new office called the Housing Production and Accountability Office. This office will provide technical assistance and support to local governments and housing developers working to reduce land use and permitting barriers that get in the way of building more housing. And as part of my homelessness state of emergency declaration, I called on the legislature to invest $130 million as soon as possible in order to meet my goal of reducing unsheltered homelessness over the course of this calendar year. This budget expands on those early investments to rehouse and maintain housing stability for households moving from unsheltered homelessness into stable housing, provide ongoing homelessness prevention support, maintain shelter operations, create new permanent supportive housing, and more. For the second priority of mental health and addiction care, these urgent investments will address the homelessness emergency facing communities across Oregon today, but is only one piece of the larger strategy required to address this humanitarian crisis. For our behavioral health system, my administration will focus on effectively distributing the $1 billion in investments made in the 2021 legislature when I was Speaker of the House. We are starting to see results of these investments. Communities will soon see hundreds of new supportive housing and residential placements. The 988 call line has been launched to support anyone in a behavioral health crisis. But we have more to do to build on what is working and create a connected system that can lead to hope, healing, and recovery. That's why I'm proposing investments to disrupt the harmful and expensive pipeline of Oregonians who move from homelessness to jail or the state hospital. My budget aims to do this by increasing local residential treatment options, improving jail diversion services, and enhancing intervention and outreach before patients are civilly committed, closing gaps in behavioral health services for children and older adults, and expanding substance use disorder treatment for adults in custody. We also must stop preventable deaths from substance use and behavioral health needs. And we're going to do this in this way, providing more funding for 988 call centers to connect people with the nationwide suicide and crisis lifeline, supporting mobile crisis programs like CAHOOTS to divert individuals from hospitals and jails, investing in substance use treatment and services, addressing gaps in treatment by providing startup costs for residential detox and inpatient treatment, and reducing preventable deaths associated with opioid use by continuing support for the Harm Reduction Clearinghouse. This work can't be done if we don't support our essential behavioral health workers and work to build a diverse and culturally responsive workforce. We must increase wages for community health providers. My budget proposes doubling the Oregon Health Authority's health care provider incentive program, which would bring up to 1,000 new workers from diverse backgrounds into this pipeline by supporting loan repayment, scholarships, and other supports for licensed behavioral health providers and students.
That was Oregon Governor Tina Kotek introducing her budget plan with a focus on houselessness, mental health, and addiction. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, cloudy skies, a low down to 36. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with occasional rain showers, a high around 50. Today in history, on this date in 1887, Groundhog Day, featuring a rodent meteorologist, was celebrated for the first time in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. The quote of the day is from Ken Hubbard. Don't knock the weather. 9/10 of the people couldn't start a conversation if it didn't change once in a while. Federal waivers allowed every K-12 student to receive free school meals for 2 years during the pandemic. Now, Washington state lawmakers are considering legislation that would continue to provide free school meals to K-12 students. However, as Eric Tegadoff explains, kitchen workers say their numbers need to be bolstered to achieve this goal.
A measure in the Washington state legislature would provide free school meals to K-12 students, but nutrition service workers are worried they aren't being considered. The American Federation of Teachers of Washington represents kitchen workers and is supportive of the bill, but the union says lawmakers also need to ensure there is enough staff to provide the meals. Christine Bangochia is a kitchen manager in the North Shore School District in King and Snohomish counties.
With this new bill coming up, we are so concerned with how many actual workers there will be available to feed all the children.
Bangochia says her kitchen has about 9 workers and serves 300 to 400 students daily. The measure is meant to extend a federal policy from the pandemic that allowed all students to receive meals. The Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, which requested the legislation, did not respond to a request for comment. Based on the pandemic, AFT Washington expects the number of students it feeds to double from before COVID-19. Bangochia says the pandemic was a hard experience for many workers.
We burnt out so quickly with the workers that we had. And this year, the workers have either retired early or just didn't come back. So we're afraid that that's going to happen again with this bill coming out.
The Committee on Early Learning and K-12 Education passed the measure this week. The House version is scheduled for an executive session in the Committee on Education today. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
Vice President Kamala Harris urges Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The House begins the process to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary. And the Federal Reserve nudges interest rates up. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
This is a family that lost their son and their brother through an act of violence at the hands and the feet of people who had been charged with keeping them safe.
At the funeral service for 29-year-old Tyree Nichols, who was beaten by police officers in Memphis, Tennessee last month, Vice President Kamala Harris called on Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Harris said the issue is non-negotiable and affirmed President Joe Biden would sign it. House GOP leaders took the first steps Wednesday to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas for what they called a failure in the handling of the situation at the southern border.
These are his policies that he finds accord with. then he must be impeached because he is a public official who has lost public trust.
Arizona Representative Andy Biggs said he is filing the articles of impeachment because Mayorkas is, quote, an immediate, imminent threat to the United States of America. The Federal Reserve announced another 0.25% interest rate hike to address the ongoing battle with inflation. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell implied future hikes are likely, noting the Fed will need more evidence to confidently say inflation is on a sustained downward trend.
Despite elevated inflation, longer-term inflation expectations appear to remain well anchored.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met with President Joe Biden to resolve a looming default on the national debt.
If you have a child and you give them a credit card and they spend that limit, you're responsible for paying that credit card. But the responsible thing too is going forward, not just raise the limit, but look at how you're spending.
McCarthy said his conversation with President Biden was good, but no promises or agreements were reached. The College Board has released its revised curriculum for an AP course of African American Studies, which some observers said downplays components that have drawn criticism from conservatives like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. At a Wednesday news conference, DeSantis said he is now eyeing critical race theory and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at state universities.
We are also going to eliminate all DEI and CRT bureaucracies in the state of Florida. No funding, and that will wither on the vine.
Finally, federal investigators conducted a search of President Biden's vacation home in Rehoboth, Delaware, as part of the ongoing probe into the president's handling of classified materials. Investigations are underway surrounding documents found in the possession of Biden, former Vice President Mike Pence, and former President Donald Trump. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The FBI is seeking clients of Arizona treatment centers who may be victims. A tribe seeks to turn the Bear River Massacre site into a place of healing. And a Sioux lawsuit challenging the U.S. for a lack of law enforcement will be heard. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez and National Native News.
The FBI has opened an investigation into government-funded group treatment homes in Arizona that could be taking advantage of their clients. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, organizers of the homes have allegedly targeted indigenous people in the Southwest.
FBI officials say the group homes based in and near Phoenix purport to serve adults with substance abuse and mental health problems. Organizers frequent flea markets, trading posts, and medical centers to pick up clients who are often intoxicated or offered alcohol. When the clients return to a functional state, they don't know where they are or how they got there and have trouble finding their way home. As a result, local law enforcement agencies have received several missing persons reports. According to the FBI, organizers of the homes single out Native Americans from the Navajo Nation and other tribal lands in Arizona, New Mexico, in South Dakota. The facilities reportedly receive government funding to provide mental health and substance abuse therapy, but often no services are provided. In addition, those running the homes allegedly tell tenants to change their ID cards to Arizona to receive Medicaid benefits and food assistance, which is used to provide for the residents or as rent payment. FBI officials are searching for those recruited to the Phoenix group homes from January 2020 until the present time and ask they complete an online questionnaire, which can be found at the Bureau's Phoenix office website. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A partnership between the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation, universities, and ecological consultants is looking to restore the Bear River Massacre site. Amy Van Tatenhove has more.
Over 150 years ago, the United States Army attacked a Shoshone village in northern Cache Valley, Idaho, killing nearly 500 men, women, and children. In 2008, the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation purchased part of the property in an effort to transform the site into a place of healing. Then, in 2018, the former chairman of the Northwestern Shoshone, Darren Perry, approached Utah State University with a goal of returning the land to what it was like before the pioneers arrived. Despite years of ecological degradation, Rios Pacheco, Northwestern Shoshone spiritual leader, explains the site is still important ecologically.
Today is still valuable because there's still resources there, but it's just that we're not taking care of the water coming into that place that's always been plentiful. And we're not using the natural ways of filtering the water. We're using other ways to rush that filtering process.
Brad Perry, the vice chairman of the Northwestern Shoshone, details plans for the site.
We received
a little over $5 million from various agencies in the federal, state, and local governments. It will help our drought situation. It will help the situation in the Great Salt Lake.
Great Salt Lake is facing rapid ecological collapse as its waters recede and salinity levels skyrocket. Historically, the Bear River emptied into Great Salt Lake, but with much of its water now going to agriculture, water from the Bear River rarely makes it to the lake. Other plans include planting native and medicinal plants used by the Shoshone and creating high-quality habitat for migrating birds. I'm Amy Van Tatenhove.
A trial is set to begin in a case against the United States by the Oglala Sioux Tribe in South Dakota over claims the government has failed to honor treaty obligations to provide adequate law enforcement officers. The tribe says the lack of officers has led to a drastic increase in violent crimes on the Pine Ridge Reservation and contributes to the missing and murdered Indigenous women crisis. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Americans spend more than $1 billion a year to import organic food, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, as Mark Moran reports, the USDA has just approved new rules to crack down on fraud and increase oversight of the organic food industry. And organic growers say they welcome this move.
New U.S. Department of Agriculture rules will target fraud and increase oversight of the $64 billion a year organic food industry. In Iowa, the nation's number one producer of organic corn and soybeans, growers call it the most important change the agency has ever made to its organic food program. To be considered organic, a grower must be able to guarantee their food has been produced with no synthetic herbicides, pesticides, or genetically modified seeds for at least 3 years, which is hard for ag inspectors to police. Roz Lehman with the Iowa Organic Association says fraud has grown along with the industry and thinks the rules for oversight and reporting will be much stricter for food to be legally certified as organic.
So what this rule is going to do is going to expand the number of certifications that are required, so all the way through that supply chain. But we're going to be able to track that certification to the Organic Integrity Database.
The organic food industry is growing between 5 and 10% a year, and Lehman says Iowa continues to lead the national growth trend. The new rules go into effect in March. Produce, grain, and pork have been especially vulnerable to organic labeling fraud, and state and national growers have been pushing